make no important decisions today.
So are we on any bills together?
Good afternoon. I'm opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, May 15th, 2017. And just a short reminder, it's hard to believe, but we are getting very close to the June 2nd chamber deadline. And we have three more Tuesdays scheduled for committee hearings, including today. Please kind of keep Thursday, the 25th, open, just in case we need that to work some bills. I'm hoping to get done without doing that, but you never know. Today, we will have one informational hearing related to how the institutional governing boards are going so far, and hearings on three smaller bills. And I'm going to open an informational, I am opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 395A. Laura, would you please provide the committee with a brief summary?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 395A would require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, in cooperation with the Department of Human Services and the state's public institutions of higher education, to determine annually the number of current and former foster children enrolled at institutions and the graduation rate for current and former foster children. It requires HEC to make information available to the public and to use that information when conducting annual evaluations of universities.
Okay. Senator, always wonderful to have you here. Did you want to invite other people up at this time, or just solo now? Or
I'll just present the bill, and then others. There are a couple of others to come and talk about it.
All right.
Great to see you all. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23. That's Northeast, Southeast Portland. And the issue before you is trying to increase the success rate of former foster youth who are in our colleges and universities. You know, a little bit of history. This committee, back in 2011, when I was co-chairing it, those were in the co-days, co-chairing it with Rep Johnson is on this committee. we passed House Bill 3471, and what that did was it created a program that we called the Foster Youth Promise, and it provided free tuition for former foster youth in our colleges and universities. It was a real commitment on the part of the legislature and the state, because we were in the heart of the recession still at that time, and yet we had come to realize just the serious challenges that former foster youth were experiencing in our colleges. You know, the at that time, the success rate, the graduation rate for former foster youth was 2%, less than 2%, actually, of them completed their degrees. And we know that access to higher education and success in higher education is one of those things that breaks the cycle of fosterhood. And we wanted to make it easier for former foster youth to be successful, and so we created that program. Included in the bill, 3471, was a hope that former foster youth would be able to kind of pay it forward by getting involved on their campuses in foster youth success centers, where they could give each other peer support and become mentors to younger foster youth, showing them a path forward and that they too could be successful in college. There was no direct funding for those. We were hoping that the colleges and universities would be able to step up and help provide that kind of infrastructure. A couple of them have, and I think you'll hear from people from Portland Community College, which has really been due to the work of some real passion on the part of some individuals, has really been doing a lot of work in support of former foster youth. Western Oregon, one of our TRUs, also has been making a real commitment to supporting foster youth. Anyway, we find ourselves now, 6 years later, kind of wondering, so how is the Foster Youth Promise working? Is it making a difference? Are we seeing greater success rates for our former foster youth? We don't know that because they are not really being tracked by the HEC, you know, as a group to see how they're doing. And that's actually what this bill does. It calls on the HEC to start tracking the success rates of former foster youth in the way that they do certain other selected populations. Because, you know, foster youth are our kids, right? And we have a real investment in their success. So we want to see how they're doing. And if there does need to be more support services provided for them in order to help them, because, you know, we know that they, even when they're in college, they face particular challenges, whether we're talking about housing or, you know, what they do during college or university breaks, et cetera. So this bill will give us that threshold information that will allow us to try to determine where we go next to help provide for the success of our former foster youth. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. You'll hear from some people who are working directly with former foster youth and some of the challenges that they're facing. Yeah.
Any questions from Eric Bono? I'm sorry, Eric Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to say thank you for bringing this bill forward. We are trying to get you high school graduates that are from kids in our foster care system. Yeah. So I hope that this bill is successful, as well as our House bill that gets our foster kids across the line so we can do a good handoff. So thank you for bringing this bill.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, at some point, we also want to look at we had a bill this time that would have involved some funding, and so it hasn't moved forward. But that also looks at transfer possibilities for, you know, former foster youth who start in the community college and then move to the university. And there are some particular challenges there with that transition. And so what this bill would have done was create a couple of pilot projects which would have really created clear pipelines from a community college to a university. And actually, we were thinking about, so one would be to a regional university, and one would be to a larger university. So, yeah. But that will be for another time.
Well, as you know, we've worked very hard here on House Bill 2998 to improve the whole transfer process for everybody. So we're pretty excited about that, and hopefully it'll get support on your end of the building. And
well, someday we'll get transfer to work as it should, and then this committee can disband, you know, because we've been working on it for the last 6 years.
Johnson won't have a job.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you all.
Appreciate that. Okay. Yeah, so if we could have Neil Nagus and Karen Solomon Vance. You never know whether it's a Nagus or Nagus.
Nagus is right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You want me to go first?
Sure.
Okay. And whoever would like to go first.
I guess I'll go ahead. Chair Reedon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Neil Nagus, program manager at Portland Community College, and I really thank you for the opportunity to tell you a little about our fostering success program and why data collection is so important. It's always hard to follow Senator Dembro, but I'll do my best here. As he mentioned, you already know, that we appreciate the fact that the Foster Youth Promise was passed and provided the free tuition for students to go to community colleges and universities. But as he also mentioned, with a 2% completion rate, it's pretty clear that it's not just finances that make the difference. There are many other barriers and issues that foster youth face that help derail them from their successful completion of their education. And frequently, as he also mentioned, they get trapped in a cycle of poverty, end up being homeless or incarcerated, and that we know that education can make a big difference in helping to prevent these. And community colleges, as you also know, are often the primary point of entry for foster youth to higher education. And we know that robust student services are critical in improving the successful completion rates of our most vulnerable students. At PCC, we're taking a leadership role for community colleges by providing a support network with PCC and our community partners, including DHS and Western Oregon University. And currently, we have a specialist that's employed at PCC who can provide support services and increase the retention rate of foster youth at PCC. However, identifying foster youth has been very difficult. Currently, we were able to establish a checkbox on the PCC application for incoming students to indicate whether they're currently in care or have been in care. And thus far, this year alone, we have over 400 students that have checked that box. Of course, it's voluntary, and so we don't really know of how many other foster youth are attending PCC. So it would be incredibly valuable to share data to be able to identify foster youth and to provide the support services to them. And the earlier that we can connect with the students, the better chance we have to support them in overcoming the barriers and the better chance for having successful outcomes. At PCC, we now have what we're calling champions, 60 champions who, in various departments throughout the college, have been trained to work with foster youth. Identifying the students attending PCC early would be better able to help link them up with those champions for early support. It would also help identify students that are planning to transfer to a four-year university, such as our partner Western Oregon, so we'll be better able to prepare them for that transition. And it's important to have data to also better understand the issues that affect the successful outcomes of foster youth in higher education. In addition, currently, our program coordinator is only funded until October, unfortunately. And we're trying to raise funds not only to continue her position, but to establish an emergency fund for foster youth when many emergency events can derail their education. And having data to present to potential funders would greatly help make our case. The data would not only help fostering success, but it would provide statewide data that hopefully will lead to establishing a statewide initiative to support foster youth at all Oregon community colleges and universities. And many other states, such as California, Washington, Michigan, and others, already have statewide initiatives that have been proven to be very successful. So I urge you to support Senate Bill 395, and thank you for the opportunity to present to you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee.
Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Sullivan Vance, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Senate Bill 395. I serve as the Director of the Academic Advising and Learning Center at Western Oregon University, where I am also co-chair of our Fostering Collegiate Success Program, which is designed to support and ensure the success of foster alumni at Western. We are partnering with our colleagues at PCC to help students transition more smoothly between institutions and also looking to build a higher education support network within the state in order to advocate for and support our foster youth. Finally, as a side note, I'm completing my doctorate in education from Portland State University, and my research is on foster youth transitions through higher education. Many of the statistics surrounding foster youth paint a grim picture. Research shows us that 1 in 5 youth that age out of foster care will become homeless after age 18. Only half will be employed at age 24. 71% of young women will be pregnant by the age of 21. 30% of former foster youth have been incarcerated. And 33% of former foster youth live at or below the poverty line. We also know that nationally, just over 22,000 students are foster youth emancipate or age out each year in the U.S. One national study found that 70% of former foster youth indicated they wanted to go into college, yet only between 7 to 13% actually make it to the door. And of that number, less than 3% graduate. One study showed that only 1.8% come out with a degree. This is a dismal outcome for one of our most vulnerable populations. As a first-generation student myself, I know how vital education is, providing a gateway to opportunities and a better life. Unfortunately, little is known about the experiences of former foster youth in post-secondary education in Oregon. In 2011, an Oregon University System Administrator stated, "There has not been any conversation in the OUS office, of which I am aware, around the transition of foster care children into post-secondary education. If we knew the size of the foster care student population, particularly in OUS institutions, we would be better able to evaluate the emphasis they should be provided. Are you able to furnish that number?" As I noted earlier, foster youth are our most vulnerable student population. Most institutional agents, those of us that work at universities and colleges, know little to nothing about the experiences of foster youth. And many see foster care as a finite experience, which ends upon emancipation. Institutions do not know how many former foster youth they have on their campuses or what services will best serve them. Much of the work my colleagues have done is from a passionate belief in the value of foster youth and their potential. We work above and beyond our daily jobs to create trainings, workshops, and support to educate our colleagues in order to better serve our foster youth. Senate Bill 395 will provide valuable data so that we can go to our administrators and lobby for the funds and support for foster youth on our campuses. My research indicates that foster youth experience unique transitions in accessing and persisting in higher education. When institutions do not respond with appropriate supports and services, foster youth are more likely to exit higher education. And higher education is a ticket to a better life for young people that have spent much of their life on the margins. Foster youth in Oregon are our children, and we have a responsibility to them. Our foster youth are not at-risk students, but they are promising, bright, resilient students that need our support. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Questions?
Are we going to have DHS and HEC testify or not?
Testify. This is all we have today. We're rather short hearing.
Real quick question.
Question.
Mrs. Sullivan, PhD to be. three quick questions. Are you familiar with Family Fine? Do these foster students get priority in campus jobs? And is HIPAA an issue? Thank you.
So thank you, Representative Winsnett, for your question. Chair Reardon, could you repeat the first one? I didn't.
Family Fine. It's a program that Child Welfare works in trying to find some family member of the foster child. It's been very highly successful in placing children with foster homes, mm-hmm. and that helps give them someone to connect with. Mm-hmm. Might even find an aunt, an uncle that's willing to even have a better relationship with them to help encourage them, because that's what they need, is encouragement and family connections. And Human Services has that program.
Okay. Thank you very much for that.
Sorry, I should have asked your permission.
That's great. Any other questions?
Yeah, the other two. Your
other question was about priority?
For campus jobs, so they have money.
No, they do not have priority. However, that's a great question. We can take that back and work with the university to see that they do. We do have supportive housing for them, so during breaks, they don't have to leave campus. They can stay on campus during break time.
Mr. Chair, the final one.
Please.
And the final one is because the bill says the job is HEC's got to determine the number of students, and is HIPAA a barrier to getting that data?
HIPAA, I don't believe, would be. FERPA might be a different, because FERPA is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. I don't believe that should be an issue.
Thank you.
At all.
So my question is kind of a general question either of you could answer, but our university systems focus on one outcome, it would appear, and the bill I just checked focuses on the outcome of graduation, yet we know that, especially at a community college, there are many, many other outcomes that could be considered to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So should we modify the bill in some way to talk about perhaps placement as, in a career? Is that not a successful outcome? Is achieving some number of certifications an outcome?
Good point.
I'm really questioning, and Rep. Solomon knows why, but we were at the same conference this weekend,
mm-hmm.
but it really raised that question of what are we measuring here? What are we trying to accomplish? Because we know that there's such a high failure rate for people going through the university system. What does success look like? And should we start asking that question with this bill?
Chair Reardon, thank you for that question. That's an excellent question. And as you know, community colleges really wrestle with that because many people come to community colleges for different reasons, not just because they want a degree. And for many of the foster youth, what we're finding is that some of them, they're not quite ready yet, maybe, to go and get a degree. So we, of course, have a workforce development program at the community colleges, and we refer them to workforce to try to help them get a job and at some point, hopefully, maybe come back and go to college. And another issue that we find, too, is that our non-credit certificate programs, some of them are very short-term training programs, like in the health professions, phlebotomy, CNA, pharmacy tech, those kinds of programs where in 6 months they can go out and get a well-paying job. But they're non-credit. Financial aid, Oregon Foster Youth Promise, doesn't cover tuition for those programs. And so most foster youth don't have $2,500 to spend on those programs, and so unfortunately they're not available to them. So we are looking at different options, but I totally agree that it's worth considering looking at other completions, successful completions other than degrees.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm getting hints here that I should be moving on.
Okay.
But thank you very much for
your
presentation and your work for foster children. Thank you. All right. Anyone from the public that would like to testify? Okay. Are you waving? You're not. Okay. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 395A and opening an informational hearing on institutional governing boards. And we have two panels today. One is President Mike Schill and Tom Insko, and then Paul Kelly, a trustee. So thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
So how long have you been you're supposed to introduce yourself, but how long have you been president now? Is it a year, 1 year or two? Or
I'm closing in on my second year, July 1.
Okay, great. Well, it's wonderful
to
have you.
Honeymoon's still going.
Yeah, okay. You say so.
Even despite last week.
Yeah. Yeah. Strange idea of a honeymoon, but okay, welcome. And you can go in whatever order you prefer.
Michael, why don't you start introductions? We'll just work across the table and I'll pick up on the slides.
Well, as a couple years ago, we were here. I think we were both freshmen. Tom and I became president the same year.
I forgot. I know I've recognized you, but I do need to have you say your name.
Okay, my name's Michael Schill.
Thank you.
I'm president of the University of Oregon.
Thank you.
So we both came to the system, or not to the system, but became president the same year. And we have a very, you know, different schools. And we were delighted to come in and talk to you a little bit about higher education in Oregon at that time. And now a couple years have gone by. And we're really delighted to talk to you about really a wonderful experiment, at least in my mind, of independent governing boards. And we'd love to give you a bit of our experience. Tom?
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Tom Insko. I'm the president at Eastern Oregon University. It's a pleasure for me to join my colleague here today to talk some more about institutional governance, and also to be joined here with Paul, trustee from Oregon State University, to share just some perspectives on governance. So I look forward to sharing them.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Paul Kelly. I live in Portland, and I'm here as a trustee of Oregon State University. And as President Schill and President Insko said, we just want to give you a little bit of a report updating you on the transition in university governance from the old system, the statewide system, to the current structure with the seven institutional governing boards. I don't know if I'm controlling the slides or if assistant and is that
I think you're controlling.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, other side.
Okay, there we go. So this is what we have come from. So prior to Senate Bill 270 in 2013, the Oregon University system, as I think you all know, was a single governing board system. The State Board of Higher Ed had, at least at the time of closing, about 12 members. Eight of those were public members. There were two students from among the seven universities and two faculty members as well from among the seven universities. In July of 2014, you gave Oregon State, the University of Oregon, and Portland State University independent governing boards, and a year later, the three regional schools and OIT got their institutional governing boards. From a personal perspective, and just as a little bit of background, I've had a very unique opportunity and real honor to have been on the State Board of Higher Ed for 7 years and then made this transition to the Oregon State University Board of Trustees. And I will confess to you that I was here more than once in the years before Senate Bill 270 passed, and would label myself among the skeptics for this change that Senate Bill 270 wrought. I had real reservations about whether it was a good move and whether it was going to be healthy for all seven schools. I have been converted to the believers by virtue of my experience at Oregon State. The benefits I've seen already in a relatively short time have made me the believer. And if I can hit the right button. Okay, there we go. So with the transition under Senate Bill 270, this is what the current structure looks like in brief. So each of the institutions has 14 voting board members, and the president of each institution is a 15th ex officio member. The result of that is that we've got 77 public members now supporting our universities. We have seven students participating, seven faculty members, and an additional seven university staff members. So we've got a total of 21 people out of the total who are actually students at or employed by the seven universities. The result has been that the new model provides a great deal of localized control, as well as more diverse representation among the governance of the universities. We have more direct university representation, as well as I mentioned, the dedicated students, faculty, and staff. One of the things, the question, you know, how far have we come? One of the things that came to mind for me as a change that may be of interest to you is that in, I would say, the 10 years before the passage of Senate Bill 270, the statewide public service programs that are operated under the auspices of Oregon State got very little attention out of the State Board of Higher Education. In the 7 years I was there, I can remember very few conversations about it. And I think that legislative funding reflected that relatively low level of interest. But in 2015, the legislature approved an additional $14 million in increased funding for the statewide public service programs. That produced another 40 positions addressing a variety of natural resource and human service challenges facing all of Oregonians. And I think that change, I mean, the legislature, you obviously provided that funding for us, but the focus on it was a result of the transition to an institutional board at Oregon State using that particular example. On to the next one here. So we have come a long way. In these couple of years, we have passed bylaws at all seven universities. We have changed the delegation of authority, operating procedures. We've got multiple committees running at each university addressing in much greater focus than the State Board of Higher Ed could ever do the operations of the university. Three of the universities now have credit ratings, which was not the case before since the universities didn't issue bonds. We have brought on literally dozens of new board members. The process of orienting all those board members has been an ongoing challenge. We have six new presidents since Senate Bill 270, and wow. Those searches have obviously, as you would expect, consumed a significant amount of time and energy, and we have developed shared service structures housed currently at Oregon State and at the University of Oregon that deal with retirement plan administration, payroll, and other administrative services. And I'll turn to Michael and Tom for the...
Thank you, Paul. I want to just spend a little bit of time. I've actually testified multiple times on this governance structure, and the first time I testified, I had no idea I was going to actually work within it. I was working in the private sector, but as the executive in charge of the largest private employer in the county and one of the largest private employers in Eastern Oregon, I was very concerned about where the universities were going, in particular Eastern Oregon University. And then also being alum from Eastern and being engaged in the foundation and such, I was concerned given some of the challenges the university had faced over time. Also, having been a student there and served in student government, I had some perspective in terms of that, I would say, lack of connection between the OUS and State Board with Eastern Oregon University. Not that they were bad people, just structurally a very challenging environment. And so I was an advocate for this, and I can say I'm not surprised, actually, in terms of the outcomes that we've seen as a result of EOU having a governing board. And I think my experiences are shared by the other TRU universities, as well as all the seven public institutions in the state. One of the things I talked about early on that has actually manifest itself through this structure is continuity of strategy and mission, transparency in the activities of the institution and decision making. We have a board now of, as mentioned, of having meetings consistently on campus. And we have an online community as well for our university, given our online programming, and we live stream all of our board meetings as well so that they're accessible by the public and all of our students, faculty, and staff. But beyond the four required board meetings that we have, I literally have trustees on campus multiple times a month. We have committee meetings that are going on, and in every case, my trustees aren't just coming to committee meetings, jumping in their car and leaving. They're spending a good share of the day going out and interacting with students, with faculty, with staff, walking around the campus, coming back with questions, coming back with ideas that people have posed for them. And so it's a tremendous opportunity to really allow for some grassroots conversation to go on. But most importantly for those trustees, it broadens their context when they're making decisions. And so it's not someone that was in Portland that maybe has great intentions but just doesn't have that context that a trustee has that's coming to the university literally multiple times a month in many cases. These trustees participate in sporting activities. They come to the performances by our performing arts groups. They go to our gallery openings. They're part of our university community. And that is so powerful in terms of providing transparency and access for our students to the future of our university. I served in student government. I never experienced that. I had great administration that I worked with, but I was not interacting with the State Board of Education when I was a student. I remember that vividly because I wanted to be one of those students on the State Board because I wanted Eastern's message to be heard, because I'm so proud of what that university does and the mission we serve. With this governing structure, it allows us to flourish. I think our performance in the last couple of years really demonstrates the strides that we've made there. Another thing that's important is really the communication. You often hear about shared governance within institutions, and we're still, I would say, we're in a stage of people trying to understand internally how this governance structure works. But I observed it last month when our governance committee was making some tough decisions about president's evaluation. And our faculty senate member had the opportunity to come to the governance meeting and share their perspectives on how that process would work. Wasn't the president in that case engaging with the faculty senate president, and was the chair of our governance committee sitting down and listening to that faculty senate president, hearing her perspectives and thoughts, and then having that inform his thoughts and setting that policy or guidance for evaluation. I simply offer that as one of many examples where we experience that. And then connection. In eastern Oregon, in particular rural places, that connection is so critically important. And over time, on some occasions, the university has lost that connection with its rural roots. And so that was one of the reasons I advocated for a governing board, because I thought even through leadership changes, we would have continuity in terms of understanding how important that connection was. Well, now we have members on our board that live in Hermiston, Pendleton, Ontario, Baker, North Powder, all these communities that we serve, and they are advocates for us. They both send the message out, and they bring the message back. And so not only are we connected, but the real opportunity for us is to continue to develop relevancy in our curriculum and how we serve these communities and such. We can't do that if it's just the president on occasion getting out to communities. I can only do so much with the time that I have. But now I have 14 advocates that are doing that in conjunction with me. And so I am extremely pleased with the developments of our governing board. I wouldn't suggest everything is roses. We're learning, we're developing, we're working on things to really function well. But I would say this first 2 years that I've experienced with my board has been stellar and is definitely a great step in the right direction.
Great. Thank you so much for your testimony.
So thank you. Good to be here, as I said earlier, Chair and members of the committee. So I was recruited from, I was at in Chicago, and I probably wouldn't have come to lead the University of Oregon if we didn't have an independent board. I think that when you have a system, one of the dangers of a system is homogenization, that each university is supposed to follow one model, and we see in Oregon, this is a huge state, diverse in many different ways, and very difficult, I think, for one board to be able to allow each of the universities to flourish and to develop in its own way. And so for me, part of the excitement of coming here was the independent boards and the ability for the University of Oregon to go off and create its own future, understanding that its mission is to serve the citizens of the state of Oregon and to collaborate with our sister institutions where it makes sense. And so I found that the experience since I arrived has been incredible. One element I think that's important is the increased accountability that is made possible by having independent boards. It is very difficult for one central institution to keep track of what's going on in seven so different universities, but we have an incredibly engaged board. Most of us were hired, as we just went through, by these boards. I, for example, have a very detailed set of performance objectives that are evaluated every year and updated every year. There's metrics attached to all of them. The members of the board contribute. I then meet with them. So this is an annual process. Hard to imagine that something like that would exist in a centralized system. And I'm held accountable. And where we don't succeed as well as we might. You know, our board chair is very, very active. I can, one example is our IT was not what it should be. We kept saying that we were going to make progress. We didn't make progress. Of course, this is before I arrived. And, you know, because of his constant, you know, some might say harping, other people would say, you know, really, really careful analysis, I'll say the latter, we ended up really changing it all, coming up with a strategic plan. If he hadn't been there, we wouldn't necessarily have done that. Also, my board chair is known on campus as he pops up in all sorts of places, right? So you can't filter things. He's walking through labs. He's walking through classrooms, talking to faculty. And I love that because it's providing information and providing another set of ears for me on campus. We also have finance reports that are for, you know, quarterly finance reports that are just about us, which are discussed in public settings. Again, another element of accountability. We also began a strategic planning process, board required. So when I came there, we were in the middle of the strategic planning process, and we completed it, and then we presented it to the board, and now we're, again, my performance objectives are being developed out of that strategic planning performance, process. And that's really important to have me know that I need to have a plan and need to be accountable for results under that plan. Also, bonding. One of the reasons why the legislature saw fit to grant us independent boards was so we could have access to the credit markets. And while state capital subsidies are vital to our future, we are also able to access the credit markets ourselves to do things, for example, at our school, building a classroom building or renovating a classroom building. We didn't have to necessarily get on the state list of projects. So again, that bonding capacity was very, very important. Lastly, and again, this is a very incomplete list that Tom and I are giving you, one of the promises that was made when SB 270 came through was that, or one of the arguments proponents gave was that it would open up fundraising, that we would be able to attract private revenue into our universities. This is going to differ depending upon the university. But I can tell you, you know, in our campaign, we have a $2 billion campaign. We're getting ready to close it out. And many of those gifts we would not have gotten if we had been part of a system. There is a suspicion among some donors that if you give money and it's part of this big entity, the money could get diverted away from the school that they attended or in the school that they cared about. And so this, we have been very successful. And as I said, more than one gift has come about because we had an independent board. And the faith that the donor or the alumnus or alumna had in the people on that board to move this university forward. So I guess I'm going to move to wrap it up. Another element that I think as we move to the future is thinking about one of the great things about our boards is that we also are very attentive to the best practices of other boards. So we belong to national organizations. We take advantage of that. We want to be up to date. We want to be use the very best practices, both in terms of our governance, but also in terms of our communication with our students, our faculty, and also with respect to you. And so we're really, again, I have to say, I've been really enormously pleased with our progress under independent boards. I'll echo Tom. We're not perfect. We're learning. This is a new experiment. It's a grand experiment. And I think it's going to lead to new heights of excellence in our state with regard to universities.
I'd like to make just a couple more comments. One, I'd be remiss to say, so for example, next week I have a board meeting, and so my board is spending half their day listening to student presentations on their applied research that they did. These are senior projects, various capstone projects that various degree programs have. And so it presents a unique opportunity for our students to interface with a different audience in that venue versus with faculty. It makes it more real. It prepares them for life beyond the institution that's critically important. And that's just another way our boards really add value for the student experience. One of the ways that was somewhat surprising me that to me in terms of how boards, individual boards, have influenced activity statewide is maybe this is partly a function of new presidents, but we've developed a Council of Presidents. And from my vantage point, it's created a nice balance of institutional collaboration with a healthy dose of competition. And we don't want too much competition where we're not doing the right thing statewide. But I think we need enough competition amongst ourselves that it forces us to be the best we can be as institutions. And what I've seen so far is we as presidents, and this goes to provosts, general counsels, et cetera, we share best practices. We learn from one another some of the challenges that maybe the University of Oregon experiences that we haven't, but we can prepare for from their experience. We share that information, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. we share that information and develop better systems as a result. But again, at the same time, there's a little bit of that healthy competition, and I think it's a good balance that we've struck as the seven public institutions. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnan, members of the committee. I think you've been probably overly generous with your time this afternoon, but very much appreciate listening to us and getting a bit of an update on this governance change, which we continue, as the President said, to work through in the time ahead of us. So thank you, but happy to take questions.
I think all of us would enjoy chatting with you probably the rest of the afternoon, but if we could have, is there a couple of short questions maybe? Laura Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No guarantee on the shortness, but thank you all for being here. I was somebody who was able to be a part of that Senate Bill 270 process, and it was a session plus worth of effort to, you know, to unpack the OUS structure and then give you all, you know, legally, you know, the legal framework just to put in place what's necessary so that you can operate. So, and I do, Paul, remember not just, I think, your skepticism, but Ed Ray's as well at the time. He was not necessarily a big proponent, but I'm glad to hear that you all have come around to see the benefits. I guess a couple of questions I would have, if we could. As board members are chosen, what kind of qualities are most sought after? As you guys, you know, again, what was in view here were strategic institutional boards with the ability to make strategic decisions regarding the institution and manage the institution. What are you looking for as you seek to replace members and so forth? Obviously, they're going to have revolving cast from time to time, but what qualities are most beneficial?
So I'll start. You know, I think that a couple things. The biggest single thing that I look to a board member would want from a board member is the ability to look at the whole institution and not look at it from a particular viewpoint, because these boards are not representative boards. They're supposed to be acting on behalf of the entire institution. So to be able to look at all of the welfare of the institution. So I think that's number one. If the person views itself as a constituent of one element, there's a danger of that. Now, we have some of that already on the board, and I think those folks are doing a great job. But it's difficult when you're in that situation to see the whole institution. I think the second thing that I look to is I think we have a wonderful blend of capacities. So we have some people from the community in Eugene who connect me to people in Eugene and who are our spokesmen, our representatives. We have people who are business executives who can help with understanding audits and you know, really helping think about long-range strategic planning. We have other folks who are particularly tied to particular alumni populations. So I think overall, I was really, really pleased with, and again, I had no role in this whatsoever. I inherited a board of wonderful people who are really dedicated to seeing us flourish, and I think it's because we have those combinations.
I'd reiterate that first and foremost, we look for someone that's passionate about higher education, education in general, and has a connection to the mission of the university, which is really about being Oregon's rural university. So that's fundamentally one of the things we look at. And then, of course, we look at how is the context of the board shaped? Are we missing a certain perspective that we would really benefit from? And so the dynamic may change from time to time based on who is falling off a board and whatnot. Someone that we would think would be a great board member at a certain time may not be someone we'd go and target because we're missing a voice maybe from the K-12 education community that we think is important to be represented on our board. And so we really try to take a comprehensive look at that, but first and foremost, passion and connection is important.
One more quick follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Come on, Johnson. Come on, Johnson.
As we, in putting together Senate Bill 270, I think one of the prime motivators for this was this is going to benefit students. What kind of specifics can you point to that are student-based initiatives that you've been able to champion now via your institutional board that specifically is targeted towards improving quality of education and affordability of education?
So I'll give you two things that are very student-oriented that the board has been very, very active in. One is student success. As all of you know, the one of the biggest issues in the United States is graduation rates and students proceeding through education and getting out in 4 years, maybe would be ideal, 6 years maximum. And because every year that a kid stays in school adds to the expense of higher education for them. So if we're thinking we want to increase access, the best way we can do it, at least at the University of Oregon, is to not push our students, give them the ability to get out in 4 years. And the board has been very interested in this, is always asking me about this, and is working hand in hand as we get advisors, as we provide scholarships, such as through the Pathway Oregon program, which provides, you know, make a free ride to every Pell-eligible student who is as a 3.4 average and above. So I think student success, student quality experience for the student is number one. Second thing is sort of interesting, and I wouldn't have guessed this. So right around the time of Ferguson, when we started seeing campuses really explode all over the United States, we created a model of engagement with our African American students. We brought them in. We talked to them. The board got very involved in this. The board had breakfast with the students, and it wasn't my suggestion. They wanted to meet the students. They developed relationships with the students. They asked me at every board meeting to tell them what progress we've made in terms of working with our African-American students and doing. There's a list of things that I said we were going to do that they had requested. And so it's really keeping my feet to the fire, because that would assume I would be walking away, but really keeping me accountable to student outcomes, and both on for all the students and also for segments of the students.
Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, in the interest of time, rather than going through some of the specific student initiatives, I'd answer it in a more general way, which is that the individual boards have allowed us to dive more deeply and with a better focus into student issues than we ever had the opportunity to do on the State Board of Higher Ed. And so I could go into several things that OSU is doing, but I'd say that's the, on a broad brush, that's been a real benefit for students is the ability to dive into their needs.
Thank you. I think fundamental, and this it's true for Eastern Oregon University, is in part having this board, I believe, will help ensure the financial sustainability of the university. And I would suggest nothing is more detrimental to a student's success than going through sustainability planning and the upheaval that a university experiences through that.
Okay, we have a couple of more questions, and we'll move on. Rep. Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'll try to be concise. In Ways and Means, we were given the four-year university's cost drivers as PERS, $50 million a year, 21% increase. We were given health care as 10% increase, $39 million number, and salary 6.8% increase, and I forgot the numbers. Instead of asking today, please come back and maybe give us some comment in a letter or written to the committee. How are you trying to attack those cost drivers? We're never going to get tuition lower if those cost drivers equal $90 million. Over 90. So you're close to your $100 million. So how are we ever going to bring tuition down? And since you're here, and we're going to have a bill we're going to talk about today about compensating faculty members for off or private jobs. I've been assured that the four-year universities have a program that you review that carefully, that you do not we do not allow professors or faculty members to work more on their off-duty than they're providing to students and to their classroom. Can you assure us that you have sort of a policy? We're going to be talking about extending that right to community colleges. So I've been assured that the universities protect the taxpayers' dollars and have good guidance on off-duty employment and intellectual property rights and things like that. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your duty. You have a great challenge to try to graduate all of as many students as we can in 4 years, not 6 years. Thank you.
You're not asking for a response right now. Okay.
I think Janelle was before. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to bring something that I'm sure is already on your radar, but one thing that we had a really long discussion about in the House here was cultural competence, but also what came up was free speech. And I think the two go hand in hand, and I just wanted to ask about how the boards have handled this really kind of burgeoning issue of how do we balance the educational experience of our students, free speech, and cultural competence. They're not one and the same, but we want to make sure that our colleges are safe places, but they're also places where people can explore different ideas fairly.
So, I mean, I think this is one of, you know, Representative Bynum, you have hit one of the biggest challenges for universities all over the country is how you balance those two things. We've been trying to do that as well as we can at the University of Oregon. We're not perfect by any means on this. I'm not sure any university is, and it's fluid and changing. The board so far has not gotten involved as a board in this. I involve the board through conversations. I'm regularly in conversation. I speak with my chair every week and my vice chair, and we talk about challenges. So when we have an issue that hits at that sort of tension, particularly an issue that could get in the newspapers, which is very frequent, and whenever any one of these issues comes about, I talk to them about it, and I get their advice, and I give them some information about where we are. But it's mostly been in sort of bilateral conversations rather than through the board. We are deeply committed to freedom of speech. That the only reason American universities are great is because of freedom of speech. Without freedom of speech, we shouldn't have a university.
Yeah, that could be a topic for a whole session for sure. I think the opportunity, it goes back to context And in your comment about how does the board engage in that, having a local board provides an opportunity to engage in that in such a more meaningful and better way than under a different structure. Because again, these individuals are from these communities interacting with these students. They know many of the students at Eastern Oregon University. So they get to personally experience some of the challenges that we see highlighted in academia, it seems like. And you know, we've had the opportunity, for example, we partnered with The Dream, where we provide full scholarships for undocumented students in a region that could have created some tension where the university got out there. By having a governing board like I did, I was able to sit down and walk through that with them. And again, they were a conduit communicating and dispelling misunderstandings or misconceptions about that program. And it's been a great program that we're rolling forward with. So that's just one example of where local governance really adds value.
So we're going to close out the questions with Rep. Solman, and then we do have two students that are waiting, one from Eastern Oregon. And
in other words, so, Janine, keep it quick.
Have I ever said that to you before?
I just want to say thank you so much. I appreciate when you're talking about the multiple perspectives. Having folks that are a local governing body is so incredibly important, whether you're talking about a college board or whether you're talking about a school board with our K-12. It's having that belief in the system that is so important, and the people that are in those positions that are doing the work for the greater good of the strategic plan and the work moving forward for our colleges. So thank you for this presentation.
Okay.
Nope, sorry, two questions. So you said that mostly, thank you, Chair Reardon. You said that this work is for benefiting students and making sure that's the main focus of having this large board, and student success, addressing the grad rate issues. And I think in the forefront of my brain, coming from this conference with Western Pathways, I was curious on your board makeup. Do you have discussions or part looking at who addresses the local industry needs and workforce needs, so that you can kind of figure out the types of programs and things that you'll offer at your colleges for university or opportunities for students? And also, one of the things that they said that folks can really make a difference in student lives as far as graduation rates is how much they're involved within their colleges, the programs that they're involved with, student government, different things, activities, and also talking about, lacking on those. That's a whole mouthful. All right. So is there any
one of those?
I'll go with industry and workforce.
So I'll go on. I'll go first,
okay,
and go very quickly. Well, one of the things, you know, we work throughout the state. Our students are all over the state as well as in the nation. And one of the things that we are really focusing on is our new Knight campus for accelerating scientific impact. And part of the reason for that, and we're actually coming to the legislature for capital request on that, which we hope that you will look favorably on. But the whole point of that initiative is both to increase the impact of our science, but also to retain students, to bring students in, train them to be part of a new economy, and then to stay in the state, to create jobs, create startup companies where they will not be lost to the state. So in essence, we're trying to say, what does the state need? It needs a highly skilled workforce to be able to enter into an economy that is the 21st century rather than 20th century economy. And in addition to that, let's keep them here in jobs. And so that's the whole point of the Knight campus. And our board is deeply involved in that, deeply, weekly.
Okay. Chair Reardon, Representative Solman, just very quickly, one example that comes to mind is at our new Cascades campus. We have a very heavy focus right now on the software industry, which is a burgeoning industry in the Bend, Central Oregon area, and it's a very heavy focus on some of the student programs there. So I'd love to talk more about it, but I think I better not.
Yeah. Well, you'll just have to come back and visit again. This has been fantastic hearing you. I'm actually going to hold some of my questions for their next visit. But can't thank you enough for making the trip over and for all you're doing for students. So
thank you again very much for your time.
Thank you.
Members, we did invite a few students to testify on the institutional governing boards. With busy schedules, we are now down to one student who can join us by phone. And Nicole Almonta, I hope I pronounced that right, is the student representative on Eastern Oregon University's board. And we have a couple of letters on OLAS from the University of Oregon students. So the from a student rep and a student body president. So Nicole, are you there? Oh, apparently not.
Hello?
Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Hi, this is Representative Jeff Reardon over here in Salem. How are you this afternoon?
Good, how are you?
Well, great. We just heard from your university president and another university president from U of O and board member from Oregon State. So were you able to listen in on that by any chance?
I was not. I wish I could have.
Okay, well, we are anxious to hear what you have to say. It's all yours. You have 6 people here on our committee, and we're anxious to hear your perspective on university governance.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for having me. And I listening to my opinion.
And I know I just said your name, but I need to ask you to say your name for the record.
Right. Okay. So my name is Nicole Almonta. I'm a student at Eastern Oregon University. I'm studying physical activity and health, and I come from Eastern Oregon. The reason I chose EOU was because of its small size and its affordability. Now, of course, as you all know, I am the student representative on the Board of Trustees. Here at Eastern Oregon University. My experience with the board has been a pleasurable one. All of the board members are here because they care about EOU. Many of them having connections to Eastern Oregon University is what makes them passionate about the school and wanting to see it thrive. They know how important the university is to the community and the amazing opportunities the school has to offer to students. I find it amazing how students or how student-centered this board is. Questions like, what's best for the students, and what do the students think never fail to get asked? The members of the board are very caring for the students, and they love to hear the opinions students have. I've seen many board members engage with students by attending events, symposium, and graduation. I'm pleased to have a full board of members that want the best for students. I know during the tuition increase cycle, many of them were saddened to see students' tuition increase because they understand the type of students that get served here, which is mostly underprivileged students. But they also know that their job is to make sure the university thrives. This can sometimes lead to issues. One of the issues the school is having with the new board is where does shared governance stand? And where does the EOU Constitution stand in terms of hierarchy? From my understanding, our board has a view of letting the president and his staff handle conversations like this, but I believe that because we are a small university, we need to have the board members be more involved with these conversations. If we aim to be the transparent board that we say we are, I think it would be appreciated by everyone here at the university to see this happen. I will say that in my time as a trustee, I have yet to see an issue that hasn't, at the very least, been heard out. Some final thoughts that I have. I'm grateful for the opportunity that we have to have our own governing board. It makes it so that we can focus on us, whereas before, with the OUS system, it was we got lost in shadows sometimes, being a true university. And with our board now, we have people on here that really care about the university and really care about the students that come here, and they really want to see this university thrive. They know that without the students, the university is nothing. And so I'm really grateful for the board members, and I think we couldn't have gotten a better group to start off with. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to have gotten to work with them, and I know you'll use them in good hands with these board members.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I'll see if we have any questions for you. Any questions for Nicole?
Great report.
Shaking their heads. They are a great report, and your president is sitting here, and he looks pretty pleased at what he heard as well. So so we thank you so much for what you're doing to help build a stronger school for your colleagues, and we appreciate your being with us today. It's really important. So thank you, Nicole.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Okay, and anybody from the anyone from the public would like to testify? Good. I'm closing public hearing of Senate Bill. Senate Bill. Thank you. Closing the informational hearing. All right. Okay, well, we can play a little bit of catch-up here, but I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 54A. Ann Laura, if you could please provide the committee with a brief summary.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 54A would modify state law regarding the budget request process, requires HEC to evaluate public universities every 2 years rather than one, and submit a report to the legislature, allows HEC to adopt necessary rules for administering evaluations, requires university governing boards to meet at least 4 times a year, and makes additional technical changes. There is an A2 amendment posted on OLIS members. It's a technical LC amendment to resolve a conflict between Senate Bill 54A and House Bill 2314, which has a larger HEC technical bill that this committee passed earlier this session. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the bill.
And Kyle, if you'd like to testify, and we are planning to work this unless there's just a major unexpected issue that comes up. So, Kyle, be careful.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I posted to OLIS is a table of contents that might help as I walk through, and actually being handed out for you is that table of contents. So I'll just take the time just to walk down that table of contents, skipping over some items that are repetitive and just adding a little context along the way. Just off the top, just like a couple of other bills you've heard thus far this session proposed by HEC, the majority of these changes are technical and they're conforming, and they're meant to be statutory changes that clean up some of the language around the change in governance structure in the higher education system in Oregon over the past several sessions. So sections 1 and 2 of the bill will add catch-all language that allows HEC to submit a budget request that includes funding for any activities universities are allowed or required by law to perform. Currently in statutes, there is an enumerated list of those activities, but it's possible the legislature passes a law that forces the institutions to perform an activity that's not in that list. And if it does so, or if it gives the universities permission to do an activity, then it can be an activity that the HEC could consider in putting together its agency requested budget, which feeds into the governor's budget and your budget process. On page 7, section 4 deletes some deadlines in the budget submission process between the universities and the commission. This maintains the ultimate deadline that HEC has in submitting its agency requested budget to the governor, but eliminates some of those intermediate deadlines between HEC and the institutions, just so that there is a little bit more push and pull, give and take within the internal budget process. Obviously, there is a great incentive on the part of the universities not to delay submitting their budget proposals to the HEC, given that HEC ultimately has a deadline to the governor and the legislature. Section 5 of the bill incorporates what the original content of Senate Bill 54 was when it was introduced, and that changes the timelines of the university evaluations that HEC conducts from a one-year cycle to a two-year cycle, and the primary rationale for that is that conducting seven evaluations in a year is became very apparent that it's rather infeasible to conduct properly given the resource constraints and staff constraints in the University Office of University Coordination within the HEC, especially given that it's a staff of only four people. This also allows for a little bit more depth in the conduct of the evaluations, and given that one of the chief reasons the legislature put in this evaluation requirement was to evaluate the performance of the governance boards at the institutions. 1 year is really a rather quick cycle and time frame in the life of a university governing board. So hopefully over the course of time, these evaluations will show some trend information that would be useful to the legislature and the HEC, but certainly by providing those evaluations every year, it was a strain on our resources. Section 6 eliminates conflicts in university disclosure of student social security numbers. There is a kind of a list of enumerated list in current statute about when institutions are allowed to disclose student social security numbers, but there could be other legal reasons that are not in that list where an institution would be required to disclose, and this just makes sure that if there is a conflicting federal law that requires institutions to disclose those numbers, that the universities do have the ability to make that disclosure without a conflict with state law. Sections 7 through 9 eliminate any references in our statutes to universities without governing boards. We currently have no such universities and don't since the change in governance structure, so that's just strictly a cleanup. Section 10 requires university governing boards to meet four times per year instead of quarterly. This is just in case something, say a governing meeting gets canceled and cannot be rescheduled until the following month or the following week, and it throws it over into a different quarter, that universities are not in violation of that statutory requirement. Section 11 allows the governor to stagger the terms of members of the governing boards to better maintain continuity in board operations. Governing board members are appointed to four-year terms, but if one does resign and another gets appointed, it's possible that over time you have governing board terms that end up being very closely related to each other in terms of their expiration date. So this would allow the governor to appoint a member to their initial term for a two-year period so that staggering can be maintained as best as possible. And then one more section I'd like to highlight for you. Section 13 rewrites the section of the statutes ORS 352.129. This is a statute about shared services. The universities are currently required to join together to share certain services. Among them is items like health benefits administration. They're also permitted to join together for other shared services that are not required in statute. Just over the course of time and over the course of several amendments to that statute, it began to lose clarity. So this is just a rewrite of the statute. There's no substantive change to the statute at all. It's strictly to rewrite it anew. Such that it kind of follows a more sensible format. That's the extent of my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Rep. Solomon.
Thank you, Chair. I was curious about two things. The governing board, they evaluate on an annual basis. Is that correct? The actual at the college? Isn't that correct? Every year? I see nods over here.
Representative Reardon, Rep. Solomon, I'm sorry, I didn't really understand the question. Evaluate what?
Do they have an evaluation system built in for them from as the government? They do not. Okay. And so, okay, that's interesting. I thought I heard that they did have some sort of evaluation system tied in with their strategic plan.
I'm not clear.
Only the president?
Board evaluates the president.
Okay.
So, Representative Rudin, Rep. Solomon, if Representative Johnson's interpretation of your question is correct, that the governing boards maintain the authority to evaluate the performance of the institutional president, occurs on an annual basis.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was that your question?
Well, it was, but I think because the other part of that was, could there be some sort of part of this process, perhaps looking at the board of the governing board doing like a self-evaluation part of this evaluation process for you to, but perhaps that's
Representative Rearman, Representative Solomon, it is the evaluation reports as they are currently established and as they have been conducted at least in the past cycle, the kind of form that they follow was really developed collaboratively between the institutions and the commission. I do not know off the top of my head whether or not they include a self-evaluative component related strictly to the operation of the governing board. I know that the universities have ample room within the drafting of those reports to provide their own data and interpretations of that data that feed into PEC's drafting of that report. I'm sorry, I can't give you a better answer about whether your specific question is included.
Okay. I'm going to ask somewhere else.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just quickly, Mr. Chair. Johnson. Thanks. So, Kyle, we've got two entities that are fairly new. We've got the HEC and we've got the institutional boards. And last Thursday, we kind of encountered a situation where the HEC has denied tuition increases by a couple of these institutions. What's the process going forward now to try to find a acceptable level?
Representative Reardon, Representative Johnson, I appreciate the question. And certainly, yes, what happened on Thursday was new to the and the first time it's happened under the governance structure we have here today. There are four options that exist based on the action the HEC took last Thursday. The first is that institutions are free to modify their tuition proposals such that they fall below the 5% threshold that would trigger HEC review. The second is that the institutions submit a revised proposal to the HEC, and the statute is blind. The statute is blind to whether or not institutions have previously submitted. Mm-hmm. So the prior denial of tuition increase proposals would not feed into the process related to the next consideration. So they could modify those proposals, resubmit. HEC could have another debate and a vote. The third option is that institutions under the statute don't actually need HEC approval, provided they garner approval from the Legislative Assembly. And so an institution may elect to submit their tuition increase proposal to the Legislative Assembly. Because that has not yet occurred, essentially there is a question as to what it means to gain approval by the Legislative Assembly, and that question would have to be resolved in the context of a tuition increase proposal. It's not clear whether or not it would be by passage of a law that the governor has signed. The fourth option is that the HEC can take it upon itself to reconsider the tuition increase proposal as it was previously submitted to the commission. Which option the institutions wish to take is up to the institutions themselves, and certainly we are in conversations with them about which option they may consider. And as I sit here today, I could not say with any certainty which option will be considered.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch.
Oh, we're all learning as we go along here, right?
Sure.
Rep. Reschke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow on Rep. Johnson's comments or question, just so I'm clear, was it the rate amount of increase for the denial, or were there the underlying reasons didn't support what the HEC viewed for the rate increase? Because I know two universities, Southern Oregon University, I think got a 12% increase, mm-hmm. and Oregon Tech got an 8% increase. And I think it was Portland State and University of Oregon were both around 10 or something like that. So I'm just curious, is it the actual rate or is it the reason for the justification behind it?
Representative Rudin, Representative Reschke, different institutions have different financial standings and have different histories with rate increases and different bases upon which those tuition rate increases apply. So there is no, and let me say also that the vote of the commission was split. For the University of Oregon, it was a 4-4 vote. For the Portland State University, it was a 4-3 vote with one abstention. Our statute requires a majority of board members, not a majority of a quorum, so we needed a 5-vote minimum, given that we currently have 8 members. There is no unified rationale that I could provide you here today. The individual commission members that voted no expressed varying levels of various different concerns. Certainly the rate increase percentage for the University of Oregon was one of those concerns. Among their other concerns was the quality of the process related to student input. And another one of the concerns discussed during the debate was the effect of the tuition rate increase on traditionally underrepresented populations in higher education in Oregon. Commissioners may have had other concerns or other considerations that they did not vocalize prior to the vote, but those were just a sampling of what was discussed.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, I think that's it from the committee. Is there, so I think you're excused. Kyle, thank you for being here, giving excellent update.
Thank you.
And anyone from the public that would like to testify on House Bill 54A? Okay, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 54A, opening a work session on Senate Bill 54A. And do you need to read that again? Or? Okay, hopefully you can recall the subject of 54A.
Chair Reardon, I move to adopt the A2 amendment dated 5/16/2017.
Rep. Wisnett moves to adopt the A2 amendment dated 5/16/2017. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Reardon, I move Senate Bill 54A as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Wisnett moves Senate Bill 54A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay. There is none. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bynum?
Aye.
Representative Flynn?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative
Rushby? Aye.
Representative Solomon?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Lonsley? She's excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. And do we have anybody eager to carry this?
Johnson.
I think so.
He's practically shaking.
You are.
We always show up and do our work.
You're great. Okay. And closing the work session on House Bill 54A, opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 206A. And Laura, if you could please provide the committee with a brief summary of that bill.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 206A would allow community college boards to authorize compensation for faculty members from private or public resources, including but not limited to consulting, appearances, speeches, and intellectual property. Specifies boards may choose not to authorize compensation if it does not comport with mission of community college or that substantially interferes with faculty members' community college duties. Specifies compensation is considered official compensation, not an honorarium, and requires faculty member to report potential conflicts of interest in writing. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the bill.
Okay. And we have 4 people scheduled to testify. Tracy Hodgkin. Did you want to just come up together? Are you all?
6 to 4.
I am on my own.
So okay, we'll start with
the other 3 people.
Happy to start with Tracy.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Tracy Hodson. I teach history and women's studies at Chemeketa Community College here in Salem, and I'm a member of the board of the Oregon Education Association. I speak today on behalf of Senate Bill 206A. This bill is pretty simple. It really allows community college faculty to have the same professional freedom currently allowed for university faculty. Presently, university professors can write books, book reviews, I'm sure they do book reports for their kids, but book reviews, articles, They can speak at conferences, and they can earn royalties, stipends, and honoraria for doing so. This bill would allow community college faculty to have that same professional freedom. At a community college, our focus is primarily on teaching students, and as such, we really become experts on how best to reach students, from the privileged to the poor, from the young to the old, from the traditional to the traditionally underrepresented. And often textbook publishers pull on our expertise, want our advice, and what best to put in their textbooks, what kind of support, educational products to add, and they pay modest sums for our feedback. Faculty are sometimes asked to present at conferences. For example, if they've mastered the use of technology to enhance student learning, they're asked to come and they are paid an honoraria for that. More of us are seeking to publish textbooks, particularly in this era when you can self-publish or we have in-house college publication capabilities, and most of those focuses are the foci of most of those are just to lower textbook costs for students. And for most of these efforts, community college faculty can reasonably expect to earn a few $100s in compensation per year, far less than what university professors might expect. Yet in the current legal landscape, most of these professional activities of community college faculty are not allowed by state ethics laws. Like all public employees, we are limited to making $50 a year from an activity that is linked to our position as college instructors. So if we assign a textbook to a class that we wrote and for which we are receiving royalties, we are in violation of state ethics laws. If we give our expert feedback to publishers in the interest of encouraging products that help our students learn, we are in violation of state ethics laws. So these ethics constraints force us to engage in professional activities for almost no compensation when university professors receive fair compensation. So this bill will just bring equity to the educational landscape of Oregon, allowing community college faculty the same freedom to earn royalties, honoraria, and stipends as university faculty. I'd say that we're pleased to see that Senate Bill 206A passed unanimously in the Senate, and we worked on the Senate side with OCCA to have an amendment that makes it clear that local community college boards would decide if this is to implement this. So that's it. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer any.
Okay, I'm watching the clock, but real quick question, anybody?
I have.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Thank you. I apologize. I don't have the list for your name. Professor, call you Professor.
That's fine.
I was the one that asked the chair that I had some concerns, and I guess we're going to have some testimony from LC and the Ethics Commission.
Okay.
I'm not sure that I agree how the four-year universities are doing this, and so you're asking us to do the same thing as the four-year universities. How would your board set up consulting? Consulting is a pretty broad term. How are you going to set that up as far as, you know, can I consult for 40 hours a week? Can I consult for, you know, 80 hours a week? How much can I get paid as a consultant? Also, I'm very concerned about intellectual property rights.
Uh-huh.
I understand some universities, on intellectual property rights, if you're working on their staff, it belongs to the universities. Some universities say if you're working on it, it's yours. So those are issues that I don't know where the state four-year schools are on the ethics of this. You brought up some good points.
Yeah.
I understand the wanting to be equal, and I understand I can probably support something, but I'm not sure what the law is and how it's being implemented by the four-year universities that you're asking to be treated the same way.
Yeah, I think every board should think about what would be appropriate to allow. And absolutely, our number one focus is teaching our students. Mm-hmm. And the only activities I've seen really support that, giving textbook feedback. For example, textbooks are often written more with a traditional university student in mind. So the more we can give feedback, the more we'll get stuff that helps our students. So I think the board should definitely make sure that we keep our focus, and we're held accountable for doing our work on campus, and that should continue. You would want that to be the focus. This is just part of being an academic, engaging in a scholarly discourse at conferences, publishing books. Not only does that help the society, but it helps your students, because if you have done the research to write a book that you could use in your class, that means you know a lot about that topic, and you can really speak with authority and So that, I think, is a standard, and it does depend. I know it from collective bargaining agreements, some have different opinions on intellectual property rights. My understanding at universities, usually the author owns them. Sometimes community colleges, it's different. But that's, again, something the board determines and in with a ratification, particularly of collective bargaining
and
rights.
And we do have other people coming up that can address that as well.
Then I'll hold my...
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks for considering restraint.
Okay, if we could have Dana Richardson, Marie Sheffers, and Sean Brennan, please.
Good for you.
And you certainly, maybe Nina, did you want to head it off? Or?
Sure. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Reardon, for the record, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Presidents. I've been asked to be here today to speak to the analogous statute that the universities have that's similar to what's being proposed in Senate Bill 206 for the community colleges. I will admit up front, I'm not an expert on this topic, but I have reviewed the policies that the institutions have, and if you'll indulge me, I will refer to a couple of talking points. We've had a statute similar to the one that's being proposed in Senate Bill 206 since 1989. All of the universities have policy statements that implement the statute, and they're modeled after longstanding rules and internal management directives that came from the Oregon University system. We have seen that the statute's been quite helpful in ensuring that while academic and other employees engage in activities that are common to the university enterprise, things like consulting, speaking, licensing intellectual property, et cetera, it assures that they don't run afoul of Oregon's ethics laws. The protections that are built into the statute that we have, which is ORS 352-232, ensure that the university employees don't engage in conflicts of interest or work that, quote, substantially interferes with their jobs on campus. I hope that's helpful. I'm happy to follow up with any questions or respond in writing if I can't answer.
I'm just curious if we have any records of disciplinary action around this that you're aware of.
Given that we've had the statute since 1989, I assume that you mean disciplinary action that would have occurred that might have necessitated the need for the statute, as opposed to...
I was thinking of someone who had... you know, written books 80 hours a week and totally ignored their students and, you know.
That I don't know, but I'd be happy to see if I could get some additional information. My understanding is it's worked well, I guess, Chair Reardon. I hope that's somewhat responsive.
We'll see what other questions do we have. So.
I'll wait.
Reform?
No, I'm going to wait. I'm sorry.
I think I may know the answer from the last speaker, but is it a conflict of interest to assign your own class your textbook that you get paid royalties on?
Chair Reardon, Representative Clem, I don't know, but I can find out.
Good question.
Could you provide us the examples? Because I was told the universities have different ones. And also the issue of the intellectual property right is different. Am I wrong in that? Are they all consistent in intellectual property rights?
Chair Reardon and Representative Wisnett, when you say samples, do you mean the policies?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I can provide those to you. I don't have an answer to the question regarding intellectual property, but I'm happy to follow up.
Follow up, Ms. Kocher?
Oh, please.
Real quick. There has to be... You can't do a job that's going to be in conflict with the principles of the state or the university, or it'd be embarrassing. Is that true, or is that, and do you monitor, or does the professor have to request permission to do each one of these things, or is it a blanket authority?
Yeah. Chair Reardon, Representative Wisnett, my understanding is that because the statute exists, it's a blanket. I don't know what reporting mechanisms they have available on campus, but I'm happy to quickly review the policies.
I think I'd like to go on with the other testimony, because I may get at some of your questions.
Okay, thank you.
And then we'll circle back.
I'll be sure to get the examples in the statute, please.
Yeah. So, Marie?
Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Marie Sheffers. I am here from, I'm the Compliance and Education Coordinator for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Ron Burson, our Executive Director, sends his greetings and his apologies that he wasn't able to be here today. I'm just going to give you a little bit of an overview of the ethics framework that we're working in here, which is that the ORS Chapter 244, the ethics provisions, prohibit a public official from using or attempting to use their official position or office to obtain a financial gain or avoid a financial detriment if that opportunity would not otherwise be available but for their holding the position as a public official. So we always tell people when we do our trainings, look at how this opportunity came to you. Did this opportunity come to you through your private business, your private expertise, or did it come to you through the public position that you hold as a public official? An exception is any part of an official compensation as determined by the public body you serve, which is, I think, why this statute comes into play. There's also the conflict of interest provisions, which for an appointed official, which is what a professor is, that anytime they're making an action, decision, or recommendation that could or would affect their personal financial interest, an appointed official has to notify in writing the person who appointed them of the nature of that conflict and request that they be instructed on how to handle it. A little bit of an application to the community college situation. We've had a few complaints in the last couple of years that have to do with recommending or requiring that students purchase a textbook that was published by a community college professor, receiving payment for a textbook review, as you've just heard, and then advertising a private business in the slideshow for some of the small business development centers. So what the remedy is, as far as Oregon government ethics law, is that official compensation package as determined by the public body, a written policy that says here's what professors are allowed to do and here's what they're not allowed to do, and then ideally a procedure for handling a conflict of interest when they run into that situation where they're recommending something that would affect their personal financial interest.
So in your capacity, do you review the policies that each board establishes around this topic area?
We haven't in the past. I don't know of any situation where we've reviewed a university's policies with regard to this. Any public body that is a state public body can send us a policy for their review. I'd have to double check. I'm assuming.
But they'd have to request. They'd have to reach out to you.
Right.
So you're not checking in on them.
Right. They're welcome to. We can give advice on Oregon Government Ethics Law. Sorry, Chair Reardon. The Oregon Government Ethics Commission does have the authority to review policies of state public bodies, at least. And so if a college or university wanted us to review that, wanted the commission to review that, they could send it in and ask for that assistance.
It might be interesting to know how consistent those policies are from one campus to the other. We just had a great presentation on individual governance, but some areas maybe you don't want quite so much latitude, but be interesting. So,
could I respond, Chair Reardon? I would note that the most of the institution's policies are based on the OUS guidelines and rules, so I think there is some consistency and uniformity, although, you know, not word for word, but they all pulled from the Oregon University system.
So they were established prior to the change in governance?
In the transition.
Yeah.
A lot of them pulled over.
Okay.
The existing OUS
sense.
Guidelines.
Yeah, Rob Wisner.
So thank you for your testimony. And how I heard your testimony is you cannot use your title to benefit you to earn money, because that's what happened with Governor Kitzhaber. Is that not correct?
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnett, that's something the commission determines. I can't answer that question until the commission makes a determination.
Please. But you said the ethics law does not allow you to use your position, state representative, to go out and say, I'm a state representative from Oregon, I'm going to tell you about, you know, get paid for that.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnett, what the ethics law says is that you can't essentially take advantage of an opportunity that wouldn't be available if you didn't hold the public position.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hmm.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think another key thing is she said professors are appointed. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I can answer that question. The ethics law differentiates between elected officials and appointed members of boards and commissions and any other appointed official meaning any employee.
Hired. Any employee.
State or local government.
Okay. Fun. Rep.
I just have one quick comment. No one's getting rich being a teacher or a university professor, right?
Have you seen the PERS records?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. Maybe not. Sorry.
Not to my knowledge. But, well, unless you're a coach.
There's, yeah, there's some pardon salaries. Pretty up there.
Mr. Brennan, Mr. Brennan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Representative Chair Reardon and Vice Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. I'm Sean Brennan, for the record, from Legislative Council. I'm here, as I understand it, to be a resource for understanding intellectual property law and its applications in this, with regard to this bill. I can either give you a general overview or respond to specific questions at your pleasure.
I'd appreciate it, just a general overview, since you're... Okay.
And generally speaking, with regard to intellectual property law as it's practiced in the employment context, which is what we're talking about here, that will usually be governed by the employment contract. Generally speaking, intellectual property law that we're probably concerned with here is divided into two major groups, one which would be copyright, copyrighted material, and patent. Copyright is something that is an original expression of an idea. As soon as I write something down, if I were to scribble something on a piece of paper, I would immediately have copyright in that. But that's not to say that that's the same thing as being able to defend a copyright. If you actually want to defend against somebody's infringement of your copyright, if somebody copies my scribble and I want to get some damages for that, if I could somehow monetize that, then I would probably need to actually register that copyright, at least to be able to do that in federal court. Now, in most cases, move over to patent for just a second. Patent law is governed under a different regime. That has to be an original invention of some sort. In that particular case, for any protection to adhere, then in that case, you definitely have to register it with the Patent and Trademark Office in Washington, D.C. Either of those intellectual property regimes, you would have to can be governed by an employment contract. And in that particular context, the person who comes up with the invention or comes up with the copyrightable material, if they are subject to an employment contract within which there is a designation that anything that they do, any invention they make, any copyright that they come up with, any material that they could be copyrighted, is a work for hire. That is, it uses resources of the employer or otherwise makes use of some property of the employer's, or if the understanding between the employer and the employee is that their time while working is engaged for the benefit of the employer, that's considered a work for hire, and in that case, any employment, any invention, any copyrighted material would become the property of the employer. Here we're trying to create a separate kind of regime whereby a faculty member could take the copyright or the invention, the copyrightable material or invention, and thereby make it their own outside of that work-for-hire kind of context. The employer, in any case, can disclaim this and simply allow the employee or the faculty member, in this case, to make use of that copyright or that patent if they have that ability. And I think that's what's happening here, is to allow the university governing board or the appropriate authority to actually provide to provide for that they can then say to the individual faculty member or through the collective bargaining process that they can use their copyright for their own benefit or their patent.
Okay, well, we're running over on time and we're going to have to call this short, but real quick, are all three of you familiar with the bill that we're discussing today? Do you see anything in here? It's a very broad general question. Anything we should be concerned about that gives treats community college faculty differently than higher ed faculty?
Chair Reardon, I'll speak on behalf of the public universities. Our general counsels have reviewed the bill. They see a similar structure that they found to be beneficial and helpful. So I think, in short, the answer would be no. I could also just briefly reply to Vice Chair Wisnett's question with regard to kind of the practice. From my quick review of the policies, I can see that three institutions have a form that individuals need to fill out beforehand. And then another institution has a policy whereby they would get the information upon request.
and I need to dig a little bit more into the other three, but that from just a quick view, I could discern that. Thank you.
Any ethics issues that are different or unique or special than,
no.
than which? Okay, thank you.
No other issues from my end. The bill looks as if it's authorizing the universities to negotiate their own policies and set that in an employment contract, that's fine as far as we're concerned.
Okay. We're almost ready to wrap up. Rep. Bynum? And Rep. Solomon? Question?
It's not really. Thank you, Chair. I would also say that, you know, in some of the examples that have been given to us, first of all, I want to say I appreciate this your lens on this process. But some of the examples that have been given to us at a previous testimony on a different issue were Chemeketa Community College had some textbooks that they were offering at a considerable savings for their students. I think that is something for us to take into consideration, that this is also an opportunity where students can benefit from a cost savings for their books. So it's not necessarily on this panel, but I wanted to mention that. And as far as I have no problem with this as a university process. Looking at that process for being for our community colleges is something that folks are working at their professional capacity. I think they would manage their time as far as any consulting, anything like that. They would do that, above and beyond their contract. So I didn't see any glaring issue with this myself when I was reading through.
Okay, well, evening is almost drawing to a close, but I'd like to hear a comment from Rep. Johnson.
It is just a comment, Mr. Chair, not a question for our panel, but in response to Rep. Solomon, I would, as we talk about the authoring and marketing, let's say, of textbooks for classroom use, I would hope that we wouldn't be sending any signals that would be contrary to the work that this committee has done and that this legislature, the body, has done on open educational resources
right.
mm-hmm. as well.
Right.
So we're not sending mixed signals that would be in conflict with our desire to drive down costs of textbook. And just because we might provide the opportunity for faculty to engage in behaviors at community college level that they can't now, that those are not in conflict with one another. So I'm not suggesting we necessarily need an amendment. Maybe we do, but I'm just saying I think we need to make sure that legislative intent would be included in whatever we end up doing.
Yeah, totally agree. Just remind folks that this did pass from the Senate 29-0. If you have any major issues, let me know right away. Time is drawing short. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. I am closing public hearing on Senate Bill 206A. I am closing meeting of the Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee.